You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Still ahead, new writing about Wisconsin and a childhood spent on the greens of a miniature golf course named Tom Thumb.
But first, the 1998 film The Truman Show told the story of a man whose entire life was the subject of a TV show, his every move captured on hidden cameras.
While that story was fictional, our next guest is a psychiatrist who says he has met more and more patients who truly believe that they, too, were living in a world much like that of The Truman Show. He says it speaks to a greater hypothesis that culture helps to shape modern delusions.
Dr. Joel Gold is a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at New York University School of Medicine, and he's the co-author of Suspicious Minds, How Culture Shapes Madness. Dr. Gold, welcome to Central Time.
Good being here. Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to start by getting into your background a little bit. You were attending psychiatrist at the Bellevue Hospital Center in New York for 9 years, and you call your training there baptism by fire. For people who aren't familiar, what makes Bellevue so remarkable?
Well, Bellevue is the oldest public hospital in the country, and it's well regarded for its psychiatric department. We tend to see often the sickest of the sick. People are brought to Bellevue from around the city when they're in great distress psychiatrically. A lot of suicidal patients, a lot of homicidal patients, unfortunately, and a lot of patients with very severe psychosis, that is, people who are hearing voices or have delusions. That's the topic of our book.
And in your book, you describe a number of patients that you worked with. And one of the first people you introduce is someone that you started to call the dude. You first saw him. You thought, this is a guy I can handle. He's probably just having a rough time. He broke up with his girlfriend. But this guy's problems went deeper. Tell us about the dude.
Yeah, after my first month of training at Bellevue, wherein I had seen a lot of the very sick patients that I just referred to, I did see this young man and waiting in the waiting area, and he seemed just like that, a very, you know, sort of kind of slacker college student, so to speak. And I said, "Oh, come on in," you know, expecting to hear just that. And he told me instead that he had been killing animals and drinking their blood in order to absorb their spirit, and his thoughts had turned to perhaps human beings, including his mother, which is very distressing to him, understandably. So he walked in himself, and naturally he was admitted upstairs.
And what did his malady, his delusions, tell you about what he was experiencing?
Well, to be honest, it's hard to know. At that time, being in the psychiatric emergency room, you know, when someone is considered a danger to themselves or others, they are admitted and sent to one of the about 10 or dozen inpatient units that we have at Bellevue dedicated to psychiatry. So really, it would depend on, once he got upstairs, the story that he told, whether, say, voices were commanding him to perform these acts, or perhaps that he had some unusual belief that if he did, you know, these things, or if he had to do these things, then something would or would not happen, which, you know, would entail a particular delusion. Fortunately or unfortunately, I was not in a position to treat him over the course of time. I just saw him, you know, in terms of his presentation.
And he's someone who was, you know, experiencing mental illness, delusion, and you, as you went along from these years in Bellevue, began to notice a pattern in what you were seeing when delusional patients reported to you. What was that pattern?
Yeah, in about 2003, I saw a gentleman who said that his entire life was a reality television show. All of his family members were reading from a script, and there were cameras everywhere. And they were essentially broadcasting his life around the world for everyone to see other than himself, and he had not consented, you know, to be in this reality show. Initially, I didn't think too much of it. You know, again, we see a whole number of very unusual beliefs at Bellevue. So I just made a mental note and kind of moved on. But several months later, I saw a second person who had a similar idea, and then a third, and a fourth, and a fifth, finally, at which time I realized that this was, you know, something more than a passing sort of coincidence. They all believed this very same thing, that their lives were reality television shows. So I named it the Truman Show delusion after the movie wherein Truman Burbank, the character played by Jim Carrey in the movie, his life, in fact, is a reality show that he's not aware of.
This is an interesting one because we live in an age where there is surveillance everywhere. As Americans, we're becoming increasingly aware that the government is, you know, maybe listening to phone calls, following phone logs, tracking internet use and things like that. So how does reality overlap with the territory of delusion?
You know, that's a really important question. Initially, when we started thinking about this, when I say we, my brother Ian, who's a philosopher, and I have written this book, we started thinking about popular culture, reality television, and the like. And, you know, it's, I think, worthwhile looking at the culture of instant stardom, people without particular talent being famous, and how that might impact people with mental illness. But over the course of the last years, as you suggest, you know, these issues coming to light about PRISM, the fact that someone might be, well, I suppose they don't need to be listening in on this call since it's on the radio, but, you know, imagining that people are listening to every call, reading our emails, what impact might that have on someone who is, so to speak, teetering on the brink of psychosis? Would that more than just color their delusion, but perhaps tip them into psychosis? That's really the question that we're asking right now.
So you're looking pretty much at the question of how culture shapes madness. And in this case, it's our culture of surveillance, which we're becoming more and more accustomed to and grappling with, you know, as ordinary citizens. But mm-hmm. What is that link when you look at psychiatry?
Well, over the course of decades and probably centuries, the content of delusion reflected the culture. So, for instance, in the, let's say, backdrop of the Cold War, people had the delusion that the KGB or the CIA might be following them. And that was filling in their persecutory belief. And as that changed, we might have seen other kinds of persecutory delusions, maybe Al-Qaeda is targeting me and the like. And this also reflects how culture changes. When we were a more religious nation, there were more religious delusions. Now, as time has moved on and the country as a whole has become less religious, we see fewer of the delusions, perhaps I am Jesus, or, you know, I have a particular direct relationship with God that goes beyond, you know, general religious belief. So for a long time, we had the sense that no matter what the delusion was, be it persecutory, paranoid, grandiose, and other very common delusions, that culture just sort of filled in the space. And now we're actually thinking much more of culture inducing possibly delusions themselves as opposed to just filling in the blanks, depending on what era we're living in.
That's a pretty intense statement, that the culture itself can induce some of the delusions and mental illness you're talking about.
Well, again, it's really an open question. We're not suggesting that, you know, watching The Real Housewives is going to make you crazy, although I can understand, you know, that, why that might be a legitimate question. It's really much more of, you know, the serious sort of surveillance era that we live in, the fact that we have closed-circuit televisions everywhere, you know, the details that we talked about with respect to the government and large corporations, the recent Facebook story, you know, in terms of manipulating or collecting data about people's psychological responses, again, without their knowledge or consent. You know, what impact might this have? I think for people who are sort of really firmly rooted in sanity, so to speak, it's very unlikely that any of these particular ideas or stories would make someone psychotic. Similarly, someone who is already in the hands of psychosis, so to speak, yes, it'll just probably fill in the blanks, as I was talking about a few minutes ago. But there is this gray area where people may just be coming psychotic or just on the verge, something we call prodromal psychosis, where they might go either way. You know, often a young man or woman in their late teens or early 20s, they may be having some of this thought that things seem a little weird, but they're really not quite sure how things are different. And for those people, I wonder very, very much whether someone who was living, let's say, 100 or 200 years ago with the same genetics, the same brain, but not living in the society that we live in now, whether they might not become psychotic, whereas some today might be. We have evidence that environmental factors such as living in an urban environment or being an immigrant or being a survivor of child abuse, any of these things actually do raise the likelihood of someone becoming psychotic. So if these environmental factors can actually increase the risk of someone becoming psychotic, you know, why not other environmental factors like the ones we're talking about?
So if someone feels that they may be susceptible, or someone's family member feels that someone that they love might be susceptible to this kind of delusion, and here we are in this culture that you just described that's filled with cameras and surveillance, what sort of advice do you give them?
Well, that's a tough question. I think, first and foremost, if a family member or loved one is concerned, they should be brought to a mental health professional. I think that's always the most important thing when anyone is concerned. Now, of course, you can imagine with someone who has Truman Show delusion that that's the last place that they're going to want to go. Or if they do, they're going to think that the psychiatrist is an actor as well. And so they're unlikely to listen to me more than anyone else. So that's one sort of extra difficulty with people who have this form of delusion. In terms of how do you address people who have this belief, it's challenging. I think if someone says, the government is listening to my phone calls, 10, 20, 30 years ago, of course, would have said, well, this person is, most likely having a delusion of persecution or paranoia. Now, of course, that in and of itself is not evidence that someone is delusional. Of course, you and I might have that, well, not just concern, but that knowledge. But if someone has that symptom, so to speak, or that belief in the context, the greater context of other symptoms of bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, hearing voices, not sleeping, having other unusual beliefs, then they do need treatment. And when they say, but, here's the front page of the newspaper that says the government is following me in a sense, I think it's probably best to acknowledge that and say, yes, that is in fact the case, and that is happening to all of us. But these other symptoms that you're experiencing, those are not usual for other people. And so that's the key that perhaps someone needs psychiatric help.
We're talking right now with Joel Gold, co-author of the book Suspicious Minds, How Culture Shapes Madness.
And we'd like to hear from you, too. What questions do you have for Dr. Gold about the Truman Show delusion? Is it more difficult these days to separate reality from delusion? And how do you think that science might need to adapt to better understand how culture shapes mental illness? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org.
We'll be back after this check of the news with Kristen Durst.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now, we're talking with Dr. Joel Gold, a psychiatrist and co-author of the book Suspicious Minds, How Culture Shapes Madness.
And we invite you to join the conversation. What questions do you have about how culture affects someone's experience of mental illness? Is it possible for the culture to induce mental health issues? And what more do we yet have to understand about this topic? There's a lot here. Share your thoughts and questions with us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Dr. Gold, why do you think it is that the psychiatric field hasn't taken a lot of time looking at mental illness and delusional behavior from this angle, from the area of culture shaping madness, instead of it coming from somewhere inside?
Yeah, that's a real concern for us. We think that neuroscience has so much to offer, but we are concerned that psychiatry has become so enamored with neuroscience, brain science, and genetic study that they and we have largely ignored cultural and environmental factors. As I mentioned earlier, the fact that one might have higher incidence of psychosis if one lives in a city or is an immigrant or has suffered child abuse. So again, these are well-established facts, well-known, particularly in the United Kingdom, but in the United States, if you ask the average psychiatrist or the average psychiatric researcher, they probably wouldn't even know that those findings have been well established. So if that's the case, more and more monies are being granted to genetic and neuropsychiatric research. And of course, treatments follow, that way, pharmacological and otherwise. But if we're ignoring the environmental and cultural factors, people are going to stop looking at them, and we think that's a huge mistake. You know, Darwin said that, you know, things, people, animals evolve because they live in a particular environment. And so that's sort of the core of science. And yet, for some reason, people are so concerned about what's happening in the skull that they forget to look around it, I'm afraid.
So if psychiatry were to change its approach and start looking more at these cultural factors, what do you expect would change?
Well, as I suggest, I think that in large part, the very culture of psychiatry might change in terms of both treatment, in terms of when we interview a patient, paying more attention not just to what medications they've been on in the past, you know, what medical conditions they might have, but more of their life history. And of course, I'm not suggesting that psychiatrists don't ask those questions. They do. But in my experience, it tends to be a little bit sort of glossed over. Yes, someone might have had this particular experience, but, you know, let's leave it to the side. The person is hearing voices, so let's give them the right antipsychotic medication so they'll be better and, you know, we can send them home. So that's first and foremost. And, of course, again, with the issue of government funding, there are fewer and fewer dollars to go around. And if people have this sort of monomaniacal, if I could say, focus on the brain and genes, then that's where all the funding is going to go. And I think without funding, the findings that I recently stated would never have come to light. And so what other factors are we going to learn about or could we learn about if the appropriate research was being done? And right now, again, I think that might be under threat.
Now, your book looks primarily at the way culture shapes mental illness, but you also want us to think about mental illness and the way that we treat it in our culture. What do you think is the most common misperception that we have about people with mental illness?
Well, one in particular that we touch on upon the book is the nature of how we treat people with psychosis. Again, people with depression, anxiety, the you know, neurotic, so-called worried well patients that come to me, people might be on a medication, but, you know, at least I believe very strongly in talk therapy, and we want to know what kind of stress they might be under, again, what family history they have of these illnesses, what their life is like. With psychosis, people tend to jump to their prescription pad. Again, if someone's hearing voices or seeing things or has a delusion of one kind or another, yes, again, they might pay some lip service to their psychosocial life, but first and foremost, again, what is the best medication for this person? And in doing so, I think that we're doing a great disservice. There has been a lot of work, again, primarily in the United Kingdom, about certain kinds of talk therapy, primarily cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, which in the past has been well established to help, again, people with depression and anxiety. But for many years, and again, even decades, the idea of doing talk therapy with someone with psychosis was almost unheard of. But we now have good evidence that approaching patients in a particular way and talking to them, even if they have delusions, we can help them with talk therapy. And that's one thing I think, again, most North American psychiatrists aren't aware of. And if they were, that might change their view a little bit.
So using different prongs there, medication and talk therapy.
Yeah, I think that often both might work better than either alone. I certainly, you know, do psychotherapy with patients who do not require, or I don't think they require any medication. And there are some people who don't do talk therapy, and, you know, they're comfortable prescribing medications, and, you know, all power to them. I'm not judging, but I do think, again, when you're talking about, let's say, the average depressed person, no psychiatrist would argue that either or both might be of help. But when you talk about psychosis, I would think, you know, 98% of psychiatrists would say, well, okay, what antipsychotic medication are you giving them? They would not think, oh, are you considering cognitive behavioral therapy for psychosis as a treatment, at least here in this country. Again, in the United Kingdom, it's considered one of the first line treatments for psychosis. But here, it's fallen much, much further down. I think in time, it's picking up a little bit of steam, but on the average psychiatrist's desk, it's really not even an implement.
So Truman Show aside, how has your practice changed as we move into this era of social media and interconnectivity and people having access to huge amounts of data and also like-minded groups of people just able to connect with each other? What's changed for you as a psychiatrist?
Again, it doesn't affect just psychosis, of course. People, particularly younger people that I treat, their entire lives are lived in public, so to speak. And so I think young minds don't fully understand what impact that has. And frankly, we adults don't really understand what impact that might have on people who are weaned on iPads. And for ourselves as adults, the notion of what's private and what's public can have a huge impact. And I think that's something we need to look at. Again, for all manner of things, cyberbullying as one example. Unfortunately, we've heard stories of young adolescents who've taken their own lives because of people, essentially bullying them online, and they just cannot escape it. And what impact that will have on anyone, the notion that we have this information overload, and it's very hard for people to sort of shut it down. I'm not saying that, technology is a bad thing, by no means. I use it every day myself. But where do we draw the line? At what point do we think that, well, again, let's say a young college student says, I've got 10,000 friends. Well, do they have 10,000 friends or do they have 10,000 online friends, but no actual friends, no human beings that they spend time with face-to-face? And I think that can have a corrosive effect on people's development and experience of life.
Dr. Gold, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Joel Gold is a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at New York University School of Medicine and co-author of the new book called Suspicious Minds: How Culture Shapes Madness.